Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
A special good morning to those of you who are watching at home. So, our current sermon series is entitled David, A Man After God's Own Heart. And we've been hearing the great stories in David's life as we progress through the books of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. So today's slightly unusual. It's not from 1 Samuel or 2 Samuel. What's behind the choice of choosing a psalm? Well, David was actually much more than the courageous warrior and king of all those adventure stories. He was also a musician to whom God had given great talents. Earlier on in our series, we hear that King Saul was plagued with an evil spirit. And it says in the Bible, whenever the spirit from God would come on Saul, David would take up his lyre and play. Then relief would come to Saul. He would feel better, and the evil spirit would leave him. And not only could David play the lyre and harp, but he was also a composer and a poet, and he wrote many of the Psalms. So we're going to have a little Psalms quiz. Not sure how good your knowledge about Psalms is. They don't feature all that much. So Richard, if you're ready with the roving mic, very small number of questions. So firstly, does anybody know how many psalms there are?
Did 150?
Yep, 150. Yep, spot on. Okay, even more tricky now. Which one is the longest psalm?
Ooh. 119.
119? Yep. Oh, sorry, I should have put the question. Yes, well done. A bonus point, if anybody, and a really challenging question, how many verses are in Psalm 119?
Oh. Cheating.
Oh.
Go on, somebody has a bit guess. And a bit this is cool. There. Go for it, Nigel.
157?
What was that?
157, said Nigel.
I'll do a Bruce Forsyth here.
Yeah, yeah.
Higher.
Higher, yeah.
I've got George at the back. George at the back.
George, yes. Go on, George.
219.
Lower. Okay, at this point.
176.
176.
Whee!
If I'd bought a prize, Eddie, it would be yours. Very good. Now, here's a question that's going to be a show of hands. Did David write all of the Psalms? So, hands up for yes, hands up for no, and hands up for don't know. That's a fair game. When you're about seven, you probably don't know. In fact, the answer is no, he didn't. And how do we know that? Well, aside from all the kind of scholarship around this, there is one particular psalm which has a historical reference in it. And it's actually very well known in popular culture, especially to those of us of a certain age. Does anybody remember this smash hit from 1978? And you can groove to it if you want, because you might know where this is going. Very good. So, two more questions. Who was the group? Boney M. Yeah. Where were they from? Birmingham. Yes. Birmingham. Yeah, sorry, I jumped on that one.
Definitely Germany.
And finally, which psalm are they actually using the words of in Rivers of Babylon?
137.
Spot on, well done. Can't fault this congregation for psalm knowledge, really. So this psalm references the exile when the Babylonians captured Jerusalem and took all the people away as slaves. Now that event happened about 400 years after David was on the throne of Israel. So there's no way David could have written that one. However, David did write many psalms in which he expressed his heartfelt understanding of who God is. And this includes Psalm 65, the first of our readings this morning. Today is Harvest Sunday, and in this psalm we can see exactly how David saw God as the provider of Israel's food. He's speaking to God and he says, "You care for the land and you water it. You enrich it abundantly. The streams of God are filled with water to provide the people with corn, for you have so ordained it." Now actually, to fully appreciate this, we perhaps need to take a step back and just see the historical context of most of the Old Testament. Look at this map. It's the map of the Middle East in ancient times. And what you can see is that the fertile regions are the ones in green. And it's not a lot of the whole area. Most of the rest of it was actually desert where you couldn't grow anything. And on the fertile regions, what you can see are the kind of places where the great civilizations of that era were, particularly the ones who attacked Israel at different times. So there you have Egypt, so you have the Egyptians. Over here, you have the Assyrians. Over here, you have the Babylonians, who we just heard singing the song about, Psalm 137. And here, you have the Syrians. And they all developed in places where there were great rivers that supported agriculture to provide food and enable great nations to establish themselves and flourish. The rivers were centrally important. Do you remember a few weeks ago, Naaman the Syrian saying, "Are not Arbana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel?" The river was a sense of national pride because it was actually so centrally important. The land of Canaan, promised by God to the people of Israel, was described as a land of milk and honey, and it was crossed by many small rivers and brooks, as well as the River Jordan and its tributaries. This meant that compared to the surrounding areas of desert, it was fertile, supporting livestock, corn, and all kinds of fruit which people could live off. But it also meant that it was attractive to many of the surrounding tribes, who constantly fought with the Israelites for the possession of it. What David deeply understood, that God alone was the sole provider for his kingdom. The land of Canaan had been given to them by God as a covenant possession centuries beforehand, and he could see God's hand in nature making everything grow. Just look at these verses. "You drench its furrows and level its ridges. You soften it with showers to bless its crops. You crown the year with your bounty, and your carts overflow with abundance. The grasslands of the desert overflow. The hills are clothed with gladness. The meadows are covered in flocks, and the valleys are mantled with corn, for they shout for joy and sing." So it really was just a blessed green land that God had given them. But David was also a king and a military leader. And he knew that Israel could easily be dispossessed of its fertile land if it was disobedient to God and did not seek after his heart. How many times in Israel's history do we read about battles and land being lost to neighboring tribes and empires as a result of the Israelites' disobedience? David understood that it was no good if another tribe came and raided the food supplies and threw you off your farmland. But also it was no good if the land no longer produced food because of drought or flood. And again, there were several times in the Old Testament where there were floods, and particularly droughts, being sent as a punishment by God for disobedience. Acknowledgement of the complete dependency on God was central to David's understanding. In our modern world, it's easy to think we've lessened our dependency on God for the provision of food. After all, we can grow food in different places around the world and transport it to its consumer markets as we need it. But this year, it's been a very unusual year. We've actually seen a number of disruptions that can really knock that complacent attitude. Ukraine is a phenomenal global producer of both wheat, it's been called the breadbasket of Europe, but also sunflowers, from which we get sunflower oils, which you'll find in so many food products. In my business, we buy a chemical that's derived from sunflower oil, and you can hardly get it, and the price has rocketed. The invasion by Russia has hugely disrupted supply chains and led to spiralling prices beyond the reach of poor countries. How much do nations need to behave peacefully and respectfully towards one another as God desires? That's the only way borders can be kept open and food can flow to where it is needed. Secondly, this has been an unusually hot year in the UK and in Europe, and it's led to the worst drought since 1976. Do you remember those two unbearable days in July when the temperature got over 40? At that time, we were seeing pictures in the news of shots like this. That is actually a failed wheat crop in a field in the UK. And there were great areas of this. There were farmers who were just giving up on their crops because there was nothing they could do. We've become used to living in a climate that has allowed us to grow much of our own food. But actually, as we're learning, it's a very finely balanced ecosystem, and it's rapidly being undermined by climate change. So it's good for us to be thankful for our food, but dangerous to take it for granted and just give lip service to the harvest celebrations. In the modern world, there is enough food to feed everyone, but only if nations can coexist in peace and harmony, and we can all protect the global climate that we depend on. God calls us to play our part in both areas. What opportunities do you have to make a difference? And maybe we'll be hearing about some later, I think, as Karen's probably going to be speaking to us. So now, I'd like to have our second reading. So, Jackie, can you please come up?
The second reading is from Luke chapter 12, verses 16 to 30. Jesus told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich towards God." Then Jesus said to his disciples, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you will wear. Life is more than food, and the body more than clothes. Consider the ravens. They do not sow or reap. They have no storeroom or barn, yet God feeds them. And how much more valuable you are than birds. Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his life? Since you cannot do this very little thing, why do you worry about the rest? Consider how the lilies grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you, not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? And do not set your heart on what you will eat or drink. Do not worry about it, for the pagan world runs after all such things. And your Father knows that you need them.
Thank you again, Jackie. So in this parable, Jesus is giving us the story of a rich man, a farmer who has produced a good crop. Too good in many ways, because he has the problem of knowing what to do with it. What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Now actually, I have the same problem. You see, in my garden at home, I have this brilliant apple tree. You might remember it from a previous sermon on pruning vines, John 15. And actually, I've got far more apples than I know what to do with this year. Every day for the past month, I've taken an apple like this for my lunch. And they taste great, but there are way too many for me and my family. Anyway, the rich man works out the answer in the way he sees the world. He says, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take, eat, drink and be merry. Take life easy." Now at first glance, this might seem quite reasonable. After all, in our modern society, working people are always being encouraged to prepare responsibly for their old age through pension and savings. So if we come into a windfall, it's probably a good idea to store some of it. There's nothing wrong with that. But the mistake the rich man makes is to view everything in a narrow and selfish way. In thinking about his situation, he only thinks about himself. He uses the word I and my all the time. This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. The rich man's land has produced abundantly, like the farmland of Israel in David's time. Yet he expresses no sense of gratitude to God or to the workers who have helped him plant and harvest this bumper crop. He has more grain and goods in storage than he could ever hope to use, yet he seems to have no thought of sharing it with others, and no thought of what God might require of him. He is blind to the fact that his life is not his own to secure, and that his life belongs to God, and that God can demand it back at any time. And that is exactly what happens. God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then what will you get for what you've prepared for yourself?" This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich toward God. That's the important thing. You can store some things for yourself quite wisely, but you must also be rich towards God in your life. The attitude of King David was the exact opposite to the rich fool in this parable. David knew exactly who provided for Israel, and he shared that abundance amongst his kingdom. Note the use of we rather than I in these verses from our psalm reading. We are filled with the good things of your house, of your holy temple. And then that brought about a response of shared praise. He opens with the word, "Praise awaits you, O God in Zion. To you, our vows will be fulfilled. O you who hear prayer, to you, all men will come." So, based on that, what should I do about my delicious apples? Obviously, I could extend my garage and buy a giant fridge to keep them in. And then I could set up a business selling them, along with a range of homemade craft ciders. I could become the apple magnate of Horsham and then retire on the proceeds. Ha ha! But then again, the success of my apple tree is not really down to me. Beyond a little pruning in the winter, there's actually nothing I do to make it produce. It's actually a small blessing from God. And I want to bless you with it today. So you will actually find at the back of church, there's a giant box of these, and I would love you to take as many as you feel you want, and just go home and enjoy them. They're a really nice flavour. Just really good to eat fresh off the tree. They're only picked yesterday. And there is a further and final point here. If, like David, we fully understand that we are dependent on God as provider, then we learn to trust in him. In David's case, there were many examples, not least the one we heard about recently, about going into one-man combat against an armed giant with the nation's fortunes resting on your shoulders, equipped with nothing but a sling. If we rely on God for our daily food, how much more can we rely on him for everything else in life? And that means we don't need to be held back by worrying. David did not worry about going into battle with Goliath because he knew that God was with him. In our passage, Jesus follows up the parable by saying, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you eat, or about your body, what you will wear. Life is more important than food, and the body more than clothes." And he finishes by saying, "For the pagan world runs after all such things, and your Father knows that you need them." The reference to the pagan world is quite important because as Christians, we are called to be set apart from the rest of the world in our attitude. We understand that all we have comes from God, the giver. Our food, our clothes, our homes, our families. So we should thank God for all that we have and seek to share it with others, trusting in him to provide for our daily needs because he cares for us. Amen.